Okay, we're going to study John chapter 5. We've been spending quite a bit of time here, but there's so much that needs to be thought about, and I hope that this concentration in our Bible studies will help us to understand more why it's important to concentrate, to think. I brought a message last Sunday morning called Why Christ Was Crucified, and I decided to call the message today the same title, Part 2, Why Christ Was Crucified. And that's a great question when you think about it. Why was he crucified? I mean, we're talking about what Peter said concerning the Lord Jesus in the book of Acts. He went about doing good. Why would you crucify somebody that goes about doing good? When you think about what he did, I mean, he goes into all of these cities and villages and heals everybody of all their sicknesses and diseases. He proclaimed the truth, and yet he was despised and rejected of men. He comes to his own, and his own received him not. Why? What was there about him that would eventually result in his brutal beatings and martyrdom? Crucifixion. Why? Why was Christ crucified? Well, I'd like to begin by bringing out the point that in our day here in America, there's never been a time that the world has been so without identity as it is right now. So without identity. People do not know who in the world they are. And the reason they do not know who they are is because they do not know who God is. I have said this often in teaching. You cannot know who you are until you first know who God is. Because he is the one that created us. And to try to find some kind of significance or purpose is impossible until you know the one that created you and the purpose for which he created us. And so I think that the crisis we're dealing with in the world today, and especially here in America, is the identity crisis. I've also said in the teaching here that the whole Bible is dedicated to two primary things: identifying who God is. That's what it's primarily all about. This is a revelation of God. The second thing that the Bible is all about is a revelation of you and me. And that's the whole Bible. If you want to put it in a nutshell, something that you can sort of get your mind wrapped around, just remember that the whole Bible is about the revelation of who God is and a revelation about who you and I are. And apart from this revelation right here, we have no understanding of what truth is. Many years ago, when I was studying philosophy, part of my requirements was that of reading the philosophers, and one of them was Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher. And I was somewhat amused and captivated by something he said that I read in one of his books. I think it was Beyond Good and Evil. I'm not sure. I can't remember. There were several of them that we studied. But he made this statement. Man would sooner have the void for purpose than be void of purpose. Now, these are the kinds of statements that will mean absolutely nothing to anyone unless you think about it. So let's think about it again. Man would sooner have the void for purpose than be void of purpose. What did he mean? Well, if you ever had the misfortune of having to read Friedrich Nietzsche, which would be a misfortune in my opinion, you would discover that it has to do with what I'm fixing to tell you. It would be better to pursue nothing than to have nothing to pursue. In other words, as he surveyed the whole of human existence, he could find no meaning, he could find no purpose. But he said that it would be better to pursue nothing than it would be to have nothing to pursue. Now, this will maybe help you understand a little better what he meant. I was given this book by a person probably 40 years ago. And I've kept it in my office. I read the thing. It's an atlas of the universe. And the main author of this book is Dr. Thomas O. Paine, P-A-I-N-E. He's the administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So, a very educated person in the sciences and so forth. But I want you to listen to what he says in a short paragraph that illustrates exactly what Nietzsche was talking about and why I'm telling you that what Nietzsche meant was that it would be better to pursue nothing. In other words, pursue an answer, even though you never had one, than it would be to have no purpose whatsoever. Now, that's what essentially Nietzsche was saying. But here's what Thomas O. Paine said. The truth of all sciences has always been and must always be subject to continuing revision. We are aware that the function of our research, like that of explorers and scientists of earlier days, is not to establish final truths that will hold unchangeable throughout eternity. Rather, it is to keep striving to revise and reinterpret all ideas in the light of new discoveries, making the resulting new knowledge more meaningful and useful to successive generations. And then he says there have, of course, been stagnant periods in the world's history during which change was so slow that the illusion was created that man had achieved eternal truth. But such illusions have always been put to rest. Now, I don't know whether you grasp what I just read or not, but what Thomas Paine was basically saying here in this statement, at the end of this book about the universe, space, all of existence as we know it, he was essentially saying, we don't have the truth. Life is about pursuing the truth, even though we do not have final answers, where we could say we have found the truth. But Nietzsche says we would be better off pursuing the void than be void of purpose. And so, I don't know whether that means anything to you or not, but it means something to me, because what Thomas Paine is saying is exactly what Paul said to Timothy, that in the last days men would be ever learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. And then he warned Timothy about science falsely so called. And so, really, the state of man in his effort to find identity for himself has concluded, according to Thomas Paine, that it would be better to have the void for purpose, in other words, no answers to anything, but struggling to get answers, than it would be to have no purpose at all. In other words, be void of purpose. And so even though the pursuit of truth has resulted in voidness, we would at least be better off struggling that direction than we would be to be void of purpose. And so you're talking about a reason to be discouraged. That's it. Because essentially, a person that does not believe that this book is a record that God has given us of God, it's a revelation from God concerning who He is. And it's a revelation to you and me concerning who we are. And apart from God, there is no understanding that a person can ever have concerning the message of this book. And so, I was doing some reading this morning on this title, Why Was Christ Crucified? And I don't know why, but one of the things that popped into my mind was a book written by Bill O'Reilly. And the title of the book, he wrote a bunch of books on killing. And one of the books he wrote was on killing Jesus. And so I've never read any of those books. I do not really intend to. I'm not saying what I'm saying about it to encourage anybody to read it. What we need to be reading is the Bible. That's what we need to be reading. But I read a review by a woman by the name of Selena O'Grady. O'Grady, G-R-A-D-Y, O'Grady. I didn't spend a lot of time researching who she was, but I know that she was brought up in Catholicism. I think she had a Jewish father or mother. One of them was Jewish. And the indication was that she pretty much abandoned the idea concerning God. And so one of the statements that's made is actually the title of a book that she wrote. And the statement is this: everyone creates God in their own image. Everyone creates God in their own image. I do not believe that that statement was born out of a study of the Bible. I believe that that statement was really something that she had concluded as a result of studying all the religions of the world. And she had done that. And so most of her writing is about religious matters. And as she surveyed all the different religions in the world, what she concluded was exactly what the Bible teaches. And the Bible teaches that there's been a long warfare going on since the Garden of Eden. And that is the conversion warfare. Is God going to be able to convert us to be like Him, or are we going to convert God to be like we are? And so the title of her book was Everyone Creates God in Their Own Image. Everyone creates God in their own image. Folks, do you realize that that's what Paul was talking about in 2 Corinthians chapter 11? When he was writing the Corinthians and warning them about the preaching of another Jesus, another spirit, another gospel, what was he talking about? He was talking about the conversion contest between man and God. And I'm telling you that the key to understanding denominationalism is that every church roundabout has their own view of God. And every church represents that view. And in most cases, it's their view of God. So what's the difference between those churches and this church right here? Well, we're called fundamentalists. We believe that a person doesn't know a thing in the world about God apart from this book. It has to come from God. It can't come from the human mind. You can't divine what God is like. This is why Paul's letter to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 is so critically important, because he teaches the fact that no man knows another person apart from the revelation of that person. And that's where I begin to realize that the way we know God is exactly the same way we get to know anybody we've ever known. It's by revelation. They have to talk to us. They have to reveal themselves to us, or we cannot know who they are. Not really. I mean, we can know the outward appearance. But there were people who saw the outward appearance of Christ. And that's why he said in John's Gospel chapter 5, ye have neither heard his voice nor seen his shape at any time. Well, the meaning of that is, here was God standing right there in front of these people, talking to them, speaking of the Pharisees. And Jesus Christ spoke to those Pharisees who could see him. And he said, ye have neither heard his voice, speaking of God, at any time, or seen his shape at any time. Well, it was the voice of God talking to him, because he was God, manifest in the flesh. He was the very image and shape of God, standing right there in front of him. But they did not know who he was. Why did they not know who he was? Because they did not believe his words. And so in the fifth chapter, as we continue our studies of it, he goes on to emphasize that Moses wrote about him. Moses wrote about Jesus Christ. Why would Moses write about Jesus Christ? Because Jesus Christ is God. When Moses wrote in the book of Numbers, chapter 21, about the serpent on the pole, he was writing about Jesus Christ, the one who was made sin, which is the symbol of the serpent, for us on the cross, which was the pole. And everybody that looked at the serpent that was hanging on the pole, which was Jesus Christ, who was made sin for you and me, they would be healed from the snake bites. Because there were snakes crawling around all over the place biting people. And everybody was dying. And Moses says, look and live. Just fasten your eyes on the serpent. And you can live. This is why the Lord Jesus was speaking to the Pharisees and telling them, your big problem is an identity problem. You do not know who I am. But neither do you know who you are. And you're trying to live without purpose. The truth is, you're void of purpose. You're trying to have identity. And so in our culture today, the way people are trying to have unity, I hope you don't get mad with me, but this is why we have this culture of people that seem to have a tattoo in order to have identity. We are living in the look at me generation. Look at me. You want to tell you why people get a tattoo? So you can look at them. So you can admire something about them. Why do they want you to do that? Because there's an identity quest that's going on. People do not know who they are. They're living without identity. You see the guys going to the gym, building up muscle, taking steroids to have big muscle. Why? Why do men walk around with a tight shirt on, showing their bulging muscles like me? Why do they do that? Because it's the identity quest. They're desperately looking for somebody to look at them. Why? Because they do not know who they are. And they want some kind of personal significance. So when the muscle man walks by and you turn, you look at him, wow, good grief, look at those muscles. That gives them a sense of purpose. When they go to the gym and there are others in there working out with them, it gives them a sense of unity of purpose. Because people by nature cannot live alone. They can't handle being alone. But how can you be among so many and still have individual purpose? Well, that's what our culture has gotten into. It's the look at me culture. Look at me. Folks, can't we see this everywhere? You see people with green hair, purple hair, 3D color hair, the strangest, weirdest hairdos you could possibly imagine. Why? Do we not understand? I'm telling you, if you read this book, you will understand it all because God wrote about it in His Word. And what's going on in our culture today has always been going on. There's nothing new under the sun, nothing new. And ever since the Garden of Eden, people have been on an identity quest trying to satisfy the question, who am I? Who am I? Well, Moses finally got to the point of asking that question, who am I? And why would you want me to go down to Egypt to lead those people out of bondage? Who am I? Well, he was absolutely nothing without knowing who God was. And so the Lord identified himself to Moses and he said, I am that I am. I am has sent you, or me, unto you. And that's what he told Moses to tell Pharaoh. I am, God, has sent me, Moses, unto you. And my significance and my purpose is bound up in who he is, the eternal I am. And the Lord said, this shall be my name and my memorial throughout perpetual generations. I'm telling you that the whole Bible is about identity. It's about knowing God. And you cannot know him apart from revelation. God has to reveal himself to you. I can't know you folks. You can't know me unless I open my mouth and I speak. And then you're dependent upon whether I'm telling you the truth. Well, God cannot lie. And so this revelation right here, you can count on it. It's not a fabrication of any kind. He is exactly who he has revealed himself to be. Well, this is a unique autobiography. Autobiographies written by men will no doubt embellish themselves in ways that are absolutely not true. And biographies about other men do the same thing. It's the perspective of men as they've tried to understand other men. But how can you ever really know the truth about anybody? How do you really know whether a person is being honest with you or not? There is but one person in the universe that knows us up one side and down the other, and there's no need to lie to him. And that's God. And so when the Lord reveals to us that the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, you can count on it. That's exactly the description of our hearts and the reason we need to be saved. And all of the things that are enumerated, 13 of them, in Mark chapter 7, concerning the heart of man and what comes out of the heart of man, is a revelation of God who created man in his own image and knows him up one side and down the other and even his thoughts before he thinks them. The only way you can know God or know the truth about yourself is study this book. That's it. That's as far as it has to go. And so we're not in that category of people who had sooner have the void for purpose than be void of purpose. We're not pursuing the void. We're not pursuing emptiness as far as a final answer. This is the final answer. This is the conclusion concerning God, concerning you and me, and concerning the future history of the universe. It's right here. And those answers cannot be found anywhere else. You can't go to men like this guy, head of the Space Administration, with a PhD degree preceding his name, doctor. You can't go to these people to find an answer. And so it's very interesting, and I'll just remind us of this one more time. Selena O'Grady says that everyone creates God in their own image. What is she talking about? Well, it's really quite simple. It's what God tells us in His Word. There is a war going on who is going to define whom. Man is determined he's going to define himself with his tattoos, with his hairdos, with his associations. He's going to identify himself. He's going to have identity without God. But he's pursuing the void, total emptiness, in doing that, because he'll never find an answer to who he is. He'll die without an answer. And he'll go into the void with absolutely no understanding of what's on the other side, because he will not die with an expected end. It'd be most unexpected. So, in trying to create in the place of God, we're trying to create ourselves the way we would like to be. And that's what her sin was all about. That she could be as wise as God, having her own identity without God, and with her mind and with her energy, she could become what she wanted to be. Isn't that the case with everybody? I think so. We're living in the world trying to be what we want to be. And what is that? Does anybody really know? I don't think so. Look at young people today. It's a case study in insanity. Insanity. And this is how young people are living today. It's a form of insanity. And they do not know what a day is going to bring forth. And if they're trying to live life without the advantage of knowing what God has to say about life, then they're going to have an unexpected end, maybe tomorrow, maybe a year from now. And all of a sudden, they're going to find themselves in a state of despair, because they do not have the providence to control the people around them, even the closest people in that relationship. Nor are they able to muster up the providence to control the unexpected circumstances they're going to face. And so the Lord, in His Sermon on the Mount, taught the disciples and those in the multitude that would listen, ye are the salt of the earth. Ye are the light of the world. And your responsibility is to go out there as the salt of the earth and the light of the world and teach people the truth about who they are and who I am. And again, I'll remind you that what he meant by saying, ye are the salt of the earth, salt is a seasoning that you put on food to make it tasty. What is the seasoning that the Lord is talking about? Here's what the seasoning is and what the salt represents. We are supposed to be able to go out here and give people a reason of the hope that is in us with meekness and fear. A reason. The reasons have to be based on evidence. The salt of the earth is a reference to being able to know what God has to say because you studied it. And you understand what Luke understood when he wrote Theophilus in Acts chapter 1 and verse 3. After his passion, he showed himself alive by many infallible proofs. That's what we've got to take to this generation. Infallible proofs. So that they cannot gainsay nor resist what we're saying to them. That's why at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, the people were astonished at his word because he spake with authority. And that's how we're supposed to be. How are you going to be the salt of the earth if you can't speak with authority? How can you be? How can you have authority if you can't prove what you're saying? Well, God has given us a whole book full of proof. Many infallible proofs. I brought this out just the other day. There's so much evidence for the truth of this book. If the whole world, if the whole earth was a library, it could not contain the books that should be written concerning the abundance of evidence that God gave us, that he is God, and we are who he says we are. The evidence is everywhere. Now, when you go to John's Gospel, chapter 18 and 19, and we're not going to take the time to do this because we just don't have just so much time. And so there's so much that I'd love to turn to and just spend an hour on each thought. But when the Lord Jesus was brought before Pilate, the whole issue was his identity. Who are you? That's what Pilate wanted to know. Well, it had been reported that he was telling people that he was a king when he made his triumphal entry. They were acknowledging him as the king, king of Israel. And of course, there wasn't but one king in the Romans' mind, and that was Caesar. And so there was something of a rub there between what Christ was saying and teaching and the impression that people had of what he had to say. And so when he was brought to trial, the whole issue of the trial was identity, every bit of it. And when Pilate starts thinking about the fact that he had been claiming to be the truth, because that's what he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Pilate thought about that for a little bit, and he makes this statement that has reverberated throughout the centuries. What is truth? What is truth? We see Pilate was locked in the same kind of educational system that America is today. It was void of purpose because it teaches that ultimate truth does not exist. We are continually pursuing truth, but never getting it. Well, why do you not want to ever really get it? Why does the public education system rest itself on the idea that it's really void of purpose to try to arrive at final truth, ultimate truth? That's what Lowell Paine says here. But why do we want it to be that way? The reason is because it liberates the human will. That's the reason. If no one knows what the truth is, then guess what? You become the only definer of truth in the moment. Because that's the only reality for any of us, is the moment. Because we do not know what tomorrow may bring forth. We do not know. The only reality to young people today growing up in our culture is the moment. They're not thinking about the past. They don't care about the past. They don't care about the future because it's not here yet. It's not real. But what is real? Right now, that's real. And I'm content to live in the moment. In the moment. That's our culture. Folks, you can't read this Bible and live in the moment. You cannot. Because this book says that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's true history. You can't live in the moment and ignore what God said. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning was the Word. It's the Word. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. That's what it says. And then when you read the book of the Revelation, it's a revelation of the future, and it's going to happen. And so we're not pursuing the void. We're pursuing answers that are eternally settled in heaven. Absolute answers to everything. By the God who knows everything. So why was Christ crucified? Why was he crucified? That's the ultimate question. How do we resolve this almost riddle? I mean, we're talking about something that's clouded and a mystery. Why would a good person received the treatment that Jesus Christ received? And they beat him so severely that he was unrecognizable before they even put him on the cross. Why would they do that? I'll tell you why. It's because man loves his own image more than anything else in the world. If it's his tattoos, if it's his biceps, if it's his gender, it isn't he that hath made us. We make ourselves. Psalm 100. It's a denial that God has made us. We make ourselves. We can even change our own gender. Let me tell you something, folks. When you rear children, one of the shocking things that you discover at a certain age is that they discover that they have a free will. And all of a sudden, that thing begins to operate. And you come along with your free will, and you try to influence that free will. And you find out you got a challenge on your hands. There are a lot of parents that have little children like this, and they want to showcase their motherhood or fatherhood and what a great job they can do homeschooling or, you know, being a parent. And everything goes along fine, and they live in this illusion that they can pull this off until all of a sudden their kid gets to be 14, 15, 16 years old. And then all of a sudden, the parent begins to realize, wow, why is this happening? And all of a sudden, their child is going off a totally different direction than what they had hoped in terms of preparing a future of happiness. And they see their children destroying themselves, making choices that are not good. And you find yourself absolutely handicapped when it comes to dealing with the human will. Why is it like that? Why does God allow families to go through this? I can tell you the simple answer. It's because God wants you to enter into what He deals with every day in dealing with mankind. The only way you'll ever enter into it, the complexity of this tension between God and man, and this hatred that exists between God and man, is for you to go through it personally and find out how powerful the free will is and how dangerous it is. I'm telling you that in the Garden of Eden, there were two trees. There's a tree of life, and there was one other tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And most people never really understand what the tree of the knowledge of good and evil represented. But I can tell you, and if you'll think about it, I believe you'll agree that it's what it means. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil was a reference to you and me. And on one side, you had the concept of good. On the other side, on that tree, you had the concept of evil. But there was something right in the middle between those two things. It's called free will. Free will. And the Lord was teaching the whole human race that everybody is that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And if you separate yourself from me, you're going to never know which one is good and which one is evil. Not with your free will, you're not. Because knowing the good and knowing the evil can only be done when you believe me. And He was forewarning Adam and Eve that He was the only definer of good and evil. But what is our culture like today? Now think about it. We are not going to allow God to define good and evil for us. We're going to define it for ourselves. With our free will, which is right in the middle, that's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We are going to be the ones that define good and evil. Not God. We are. And so, the proof of it is the marriage amendment. Well, God says marriage is between a man and a woman. And he tells us how to go about it. He says, do not marry unequally yoked. God said that. We are determined that that's not true. And we can go out here and marry anything that looks good, and it's going to turn out okay. But that's because we do not believe what the Bible has to say about free will. When a boy and a girl get married, they enter into it with the pride that somehow or other they're going to control the free will of the person they've gotten involved with in such a way that there's never going to be a conflict. The real reason they got married doesn't have anything to do with the thought life of the other individual. That doesn't come till later. You do not discover in marriage that your marriage is to another person who has a free will that does not think the way you do. And so the question is, how can two people ever get married and have unity and stay together and not get divorced? And the answer is very simple. The Lord said to not marry unequally yoked. What did he mean? He said, marry a girl that has received as her mind the mind of Jesus Christ. He says to the girl, marry a boy that has the mind of Christ. And if you'll do that, you'll both think alike when it comes to the final decision of what is the right thing to do. And so, if two people have the mind of Christ, they can be one not only with each other, but with God. And that's the great purpose of the Bible. Marriage being a symbol of realizing that we made a mistake when we thought that we could be as wise as God and be happy without him. The Lord's message is you can have blessing. You can be supremely happy if your desire is to die to everything that you are and receive as your life, my life, my life. As your life. Christ was crucified because man loves himself more than God. And if he tries to get in the way of that, man will kill him. He'll kill him. He'll kill him in his mind by refusing to come to church, by refusing to study this Bible, by refusing to have fellowship with other believers. He'll kill God every way he turns because he wants to live for himself. Our time is gone. I hope that these things will be meaningful to us all. Let's look to the Lord in prayer. Art, dismiss us, brother.
Things we pray for.